Okay, good morning, everyone. We are going to look at a number of beautiful insights for your pleasure today to be shared at the Seder, God willing. The source sheets you have in front of you are rich with textual sources, but even if you don't feel comfortable with the Hebrew, it's not a problem. We're going to go through the text nice and slow, and hopefully you'll leave with at least 10 nice ideas to share at your Passover Seder. So let's start with Halach Ma'anya. Halach Ma'anya is part of the Seder where we lift up the matzahs and we say, this is the bread of our affliction, right? And it's not just because sometimes the matzah can afflict our digestive systems, of course. It's a reference to the fact that matzah represents our slavery in Mitzrayim. It's interesting that as part of this passage, we say, whoever is hungry, let them come and eat, right? Kol dichvin, whoever is in need. Let me find the exact language. So I'm just opening my Haggadah. I want to get it correct. Kol dichvin yetze v'yechol. Something along those lines, although I will confirm with you in just a moment. The problem with using Haggadahs that are rich with information is you have to flip about 10-15 pages to go from one stage of the Haggadah to the next. So we say in the Halach Ma'anya, Kol dichvin yese v'yechol, whoever is hungry, let them come and eat. So why is that such an important part of the Seder? Really to the extent that we put it at the very beginning. Before the meat and potatoes, if you will, although the real meat and potatoes come much later. But before we jump into talking about the Exodus from Egypt, we raise up the matzah and we say, whoever is hungry, let them come and eat. Why is that such an integral part of the Seder experience that we put it at the very beginning? So one answer, very simply, is that this is the hallmark of every single Jewish home on every single holiday. It's not unique just to Passover. If you look in the Rambam in source number one, again, even if you don't feel very comfortable with the Hebrew, I'm going to read and translate. The Rambam tells us that there are very strict guidelines in terms of how a Jew celebrates any holiday. The Rambam writes, Shiva simei ha-Pesach v'shmona simei ha-Chag. When it comes to the 7 days of Passover, the 8 days of Sukkot, im shar yamim tovim, with all the other holidays, kulam asurim behesped uvetainis, we're not allowed to eulogize, we're not allowed to fast. I think there's some sheets in the back. V'chayiv adam liyos bahen sameach v'tov lev. A person has to be happy and in a good mood and good spirits on the holidays. You don't just do that for yourself. Hu uvana v'ishto, both yourself, your wife, your spouse, uvnei beso, and people in your home, v'chol ha'nelvim alav, all the people that are dependent upon you. So when you come to celebrate any Jewish holiday, you don't do it by yourself, you do it with your family and with your children. And the Rambam goes on, next halacha, ketzad ha'ketanim nosin lahem kloyos ve'gozim umagdanos. You give the kids like nuts and candies, that's how they get happy on the Yantif. V'hanashim kona lahem v'gadim. For women, you have to buy them clothing. So Bob, you're listening carefully, okay? It's a good thing Karen's not here, Howie. That when it comes to the women, you have to buy them beautiful clothing and jewelry. It actually says here, the more carrots, the better. No, I'm just kidding. But you have to buy your wife a nice clothing. Kifi mamona, everyone according to the resources that they have. Leon, I might have run out of sheets. I apologize. We'll go through the text nice and slowly. So again, you have to provide for the people in your home what they need, what makes them happy. V'ha'anashim ochlin basar v'shos inyayim. The men have to eat meat and drink wine. Shein simcha ella b'basar v'ein simcha ella b'yayim. For men, the way to get to a man's heart is through some delicious steak and some fine wine. But here's the part I really wanted to share with you. V'kishu ochel v'shoseh. When a person eats and drinks, chayiv l'hachil ager liyasom v'lamana. A person has to make sure that they're also providing for the ger. The ger is a convert, a foreign, but here it refers more to a convert, someone who doesn't otherwise have family. Yasom is an orphan, and almana is a widow. So when a Jew sits down to celebrate, they don't just sit down by themselves, and they're not just caring about their family. a Jew has to have in mind to care for those who are not cared for by others. This is not unique to Pesach. Every single Jewish holiday demands that our sphere of influence, if you will, right, those who we care for, extends well beyond just our immediate families. And we think about those people who are not otherwise being gladdened and who are having a difficult time. And look at what the Rambam says in the next paragraph. Shabbos, probably it's important to do so on Shabbos, but there's a particular focus of simcha on Yontif. We have a particular focus on happiness on the festivals, and that happiness must spill over to others. In fact, the Rambam has very strong language. The Rambam writes about Misha Noel Dalosos Chatzero. If a person, what's Noel? Noel's to lock. If a person locks the gateway to their home, V'ochel v'shosehu uvana v'ishto, and only gladdens himself, his wife, and his children, ve'eno machil u'mashke le'aniyim u'lemari nafesh, a person does not provide food and drink for those who are poor and downtrodden, ein zu simchas mitzvah, this is not considered to be the happiness of a mitzvah, ela simchas kreso. What's simchas kreso? The happiness of your belly, of your stomach. So if a person only provides for himself and his family and does not think about others, it is not considered to be real happiness. You're not truly servicing the Almighty, you're servicing yourself. So we start the Seder with Halach Ma'anya. This is the bread of our affliction. And we raise up the bread and we say, Kol Dichvin Yese V'Yechol. Whoever is hungry, let them come and eat. Because it's a statement that Jews don't celebrate by themselves. They celebrate with others, particularly others in need. And I always found it fascinating that the language of the Rambam, when describing those people in need, is twofold. Look very carefully at what the Rambam writes. The Rambam, this is in the last paragraph. The Rambam says the bolder words. Whoever is not machil o mashke la'aniyim, what are aniyim? Aniyim are people who are literally poor, people who are destitute, who don't have enough to provide for themselves. But the Rambam doesn't just stop there. What else does the Rambam say? Whoever does not provide for those who are poor, ulemare nefesh. What are mare nefesh? Well, what's mar? What's maror? Bitter. Mare nefesh, people of a bitter soul. I don't believe that that's referring to people who lack resources. The people who lack resources are encompassed in the word aniyim. The Rambam already said that. The Rambam says, exactly. The Rambam is saying, whoever does not provide for the poor, but also those who are afflicted. What does that mean? What do you think that means?
Sick.
Sick. Sad. People who are alone. People who are alone. That's the way I think about it. Think of all the shut-ins in our community who might not otherwise be sharing a meal with anybody. Reaching out to those people is exactly what the Rambam is demanding of us. And that's the statement that we make when we start the Seder, Kol Dichvin Yesev Yechol. Whoever is hungry, let them come and eat. And the Abu Draham in source number 2 actually tells us that it used to be, in the olden days, we would open up our doors, and the poor people who were still scrambling, you know, running around trying to find a Seder, they would see an open door, they'd run in, and they'd join a Seder. Literally, the statement was a sincere invitation. Whoever has yet to find themselves a Seder, come on in! But, the Abu Draham writes, that since the Jews have moved in to communities with Gentiles, so if we open our door, we don't know who's going to come in. So this way, the Abu Draham says, really what we do now is kimcha de pischa. We provide Passover funds in advance of Pesach to make sure that people who need help buying food for the Pesach Seder are provided for. And this statement is really more perfunctory than it is anything else. It's not a sincere invitation because people are not running around trying to find a last minute Seder anymore. But the statement is still there because it underscores the Jewish value that when we sit down to enjoy, we don't do so alone. Let me just read from the text and I'll take your question. Abu Draham writes in source number 2, Kasav Rav Matitya. Mashanahagu lomar kol dichvin yesiv eichol. The custom to say, whoever is hungry, let them come and eat. Kach haya min hagavos. This was the custom of the fathers. Shayu magbi in shulchon oseyem. They would raise up their, literally means their table. Probably means the Seder plate, or maybe it was. They raised up the table that they were sitting by. Volohayu sogrin dal oseyem. They would not close their door, right? That's a parallel to language of the Rambam. Talks about those who lock their door. That Rav Matisya says, the Jews would not close their doors. Vahayu omrim kacha. They would actually say, whoever is hungry, come and let them eat. Kidei sheyavou yisroel ha'aniyim shebineihem. So that the Jews amongst them would come le'achol ulekabel schar ha'yosin zeh. The Jews would open their doors and invite others in to receive reward for doing acts of kindness. V'achshav shena'asu shechinei akum. Yoser Mishchine Yisrael. So nowadays that we have non-Jewish neighbors more than Jewish neighbors, Mefarnesin Osam Bitchila, Kedeshul Yachzru Al Pesachim. So nowadays we provide money for the poor in advance, so that the poor are not going to be running around on the night of the Seder trying to find a place to go. We will have already taken care of them in advance of the Passover Seder. Leon, you had a question?
I thought that when he is saying here, la guerre,
right,
obviously this tradition must have changed depending on the situation of the Jews. When Jews were in Israel or Palestine, right, the guerre, the non-Jew, was probably a citizen of the... So I think that calling him a guerre,
right,
he must have been invited.
Interesting, right? It absolutely could be. I think the Rambam is using it more symbolically as people who don't have family.
No, but the Rambam is not a citizen of a Jewish state.
Okay.
He's talking about exiles.
Okay, so he probably has a more acute understanding of what it means to be a foreigner.
So the whole concept,
right,
is probably shrunk to my own people.
Okay, that could be. But I don't think that's the exclusive meaning of the term. I think the term ger really refers to converts, people who otherwise don't have family to be part of the Seder. That's my thinking.
You're saying that to people who lived in the Jewish state, during the monarchy,
right,
even before, did not necessarily have to be Jews.
I'm not saying that one way or the other. I'm just saying that the word ger classically refers to people who are converts, literally converts, who don't otherwise have family. Dr. Schlesser.
I heard that you're not supposed to have non-Jewish people at your Seder.
Right, so there's a halacha that you're not allowed to invite Gentiles to any Yom Tov meal. We're allowed to cook on Yom Tov, but we're only allowed to cook for fellow Jews. So as such, you're supposed to only have Jewish people at all Yom Tov meals, including Siddur. It's a little complex. It happens to be that I'm working right now with a family where the husband is Jewish and the wife is not. We wanted to have them for the Seder, so I had to seek halachic guidance how to go navigate through that issue. So it's a thorny issue, and it's one that you have to consult a Rav on a case-by-case basis.
I didn't know it was all Yom Tov.
Yeah, no, it's all yontif because the Torah allows us to cook, but the cooking has to be for a Jew. Dr. Lister, you're going to say something? No? Okay, I want to share with you another idea, a beautiful idea Rabbi Soloveitchik teaches us regarding the centrality of chesed, of kindness, and why that kicks off the Seder experience. Because again, we start with halach ma'anya, and we invite people in. Listen to the beautiful words of the Rav. This is found in his book, Festivals of Freedom. Festival in the singular of freedom. So the Rav writes in source number 3, Chesed is the characteristic mark of the free man. The bondsman is not spiritually capable of joining the Chesed community because he is too much concerned with himself. Only free and proud people think of others and share with others. The birth of the Chesed community is symbolized by the Paschal sacrifice. God simply wanted the people, slaves who had just come out of the house of bondage, to emerge from their isolation and insane self-centeredness into the chesed community. So let's try to unpack what the Rav is writing over here. So what the Rav means is as follows. When a person is enslaved, when they're shackled, it's nearly impossible to think of anybody else. When a person is literally enslaved, they are so overwhelmed by the circumstances of their own lot in life, they can't think about giving to others, they just think about survival. We start off the Seder with the ultimate mark of freedom. What is the ultimate mark of freedom? The ability to think of someone else. To have the expansiveness of mind to think about what other people might need. And that's why we start Halach Ma'anya with Kol Dichvin Yesev Yechol. Whoever is hungry, let them come and eat. That is my greatest mark of freedom. That I can think about somebody else. And sets the tone for the entire night. I think it's such a beautiful idea. He refers to the Paschal lamb because we know that one of the unique parts of the Korban Pesach is that it had to be eaten b'chabura, in a group, and you had to make the calculations in advance. Okay, how many people can I invite? Will I have enough meat? I have to make sure everyone has enough, but we have to make sure there's not left over. You had to really think about who you were going to invite, how you're going to do it. It was a very, very deliberate process. But embedded in that process was the need to think about others. Can you come and join my Seder? I've got this big lamb that I'm preparing. I have to make sure that it all goes. By definition, it involved reaching out to others. And Hashem gives us the Korban Pesach as one of the very first mitzvos because it demanded that we think about others. We removed ourselves from our self-centered perspective to now a perspective of thinking of others. That's the mark of a free man. That's why it starts off the Seder. Yes?
When you say others. Freedom means you can think of others.
Right.
Other Jews or other people.
Other people in general.
In general.
Obviously, in the night of the Seder, we are more parochial in our vision because it's the night when we start out as a people. Our peoplehood really begins from the Exodus from Egypt, but it doesn't have to be uniquely so. The ability to give is not a something that we limit just to the Jewish people. The Jewish people are magnanimous to the all of humanity, if necessary. Yes?
Tell me, how do you translate hesed? To me, hesed is always a righteous person.
No, it means kindness. I think that's the very simple understanding. Yeah. Kindness.
But is kindness advancement opposites?
Well, that's what the Rav is suggesting. It doesn't have to.
There's something here with pulling a fast one on us.
No, I don't think so. I think that this is in the realm of drash that the Rav is expounding upon a certain idea. It's not the only idea, but he's suggesting
but
that the ability.
What I'm saying, he is endowing the person he's talking with certain qualities or attributes which reinforces our.
Okay. Let that be. I don't think it detracts from the quality of the insight.
To words. I mean, words have a meaning. He just cannot do that.
So
a good man is going to do good deeds. That's what he is saying.
I think it's a little bit deeper. I think he's saying that a person who's in slavery doesn't have the ability to really think beyond
that's
himself.
That's correct.
Right.
But he should distinguish.
It's a fair point. Okay, so let's move on. So we start with Halach Manya, 2 insights from Halach Manya. I have to make sure I reach 10. I said 10 insights. I didn't say only 10, but I have to make sure I reach my target of 10. So we have Rambam number 1, that the mark of a Jew is to share with others. So we start by inviting others to our Seder. And number 2, the mark of a free man is someone who has the ability to think about others. Let's look at Manishtana for now. Manishtana is a very interesting, certainly it's a central part of the Seder experience. It's also a very interesting passage. The Abraham Vanel in source number 4 basically says the following, and then we'll read it inside in a minute or two, but the Abraham Vanel says that the entire Manishtana can be encapsulated in one idea. That this is an evening of contradictions. These are not 4 disparate questions. This is one question with 4 parts to it. The one question is that the child is asking his parents, why is this night fraught with contradictions? Because on the one hand, the rest of the year, we can eat whatever we want. Tonight we uniquely eat matzah. Matzah is the bread of affliction, so it shows a component of slavery. The rest of the year, we can eat whatever vegetables we want, or if you're like some of my children, you'll stay away from the vegetables. But you don't have to eat a specific herb, a specific bitter herb, whatever you want. But tonight, eat a bitter herb, a mark of slavery, affliction. So we have the matzah and the maror, which represent slavery. They are restrictions. We have to eat matzah. We have to eat the bitter herb. So we're acting like slaves. On the other hand, we do other elements at the Seder that remind us of slavery. Of freedom, of royalty. We dip multiple times. Dipping was like a very luxurious act. It was like a smorgasbord. We start before we even eat the meal with some vegetable dipped in delicious salt water. I'm going to recommend that at this year's shul dinner we have someone carrying around, you know, potatoes and salt water. It's like a mark of freedom. Right, but the point is that the dipping, the multiple dippings in particular, represents freedom, and the leaning represents freedom. So the child is essentially asking his parents one question. Mom and Dad, Ima and Abba, Tati and Mommy, what's the Yiddish? Mama, okay, Mama. So Nu, what's going on here? What are we doing here at the Seder? Are we acting like free people, in the sense that we're dipping multiple times and we're leaning, or are we acting like slaves? That's the essential question of the Manishtana. Why is tonight fraught with inconsistencies and contradictions? Look at what the Abravanel writes in source number 4. Manishtana halayla zeh mikol halaylos, shebekol halaylos. Lefi shebelayla hazeh, anu osim inyanim, on this night we do matters, morim al hayosanu b'nei chorim, we do things which speak about our freedom, b'nei chorin. V'osim inyanim acherim lehefech. We do matters that are the opposite. Morim al hayosanu avadim. Talking about our slavery. Nichna'im v'zuyim v'shrelim, our lowliness. Kihena b'chol ha'leilos en anu nohagim litzbol kodem ha'seuda afilu pamachas. The rest of the year, we don't dip before the meal. We don't eat a smorgasbord before the meal. We dip twice. It's a freedom. They're like delicacies. The rest of the year, we eat whatever we want, matzah or bread. We're obligated to eat matzah. The zemora al avadim. This shows our slavery. It's the bread of those who are afflicted, who are working, can't wait for the bread to rise, so on and so forth. So I think you get the gist of the Abravanel. It's fraught with contradictions. What's going on here? Parenthetically, I smiled when I was preparing this shiur because it reminded me of something I think that we all know is so true, and that is that kids pick up on their parents' inconsistencies like that, right? We can preach all we want from today to tomorrow. If we happen to veer off of the path of what we have been talking about, our kids are the ones that notice it immediately. So it's not surprising that the child is the one that says, Manishtana, what's going on here, Dad? Right? There is an inconsistency tonight. How are we to explain that? So I think that's a very nice idea, the Abravanel in general, putting aside the children noticing the inconsistencies, because it frames the Manishtana as one unit, as opposed to four different questions that are kind of jumbled, that don't really relate one to the other. Now we can look at the Manishtana as one unit. One general idea, why are we flip-flopping back and forth between slavery and freedom? So if that is essentially the question of the Manishtana, then what's the answer? What's the answer? Avadim hayinu, what does that mean? Right? We immediately go from the Manishtana to talking about the fact that we were slaves to Paro. How does that answer the question? I think it's quite obvious, right? It answers the question because we were slaves to Paro, and tonight's the night when we were freed. Even though the actual backbreaking labor stopped well before this, when the plague has already started, But the bottom line is that our freedom did not come until this evening. So this evening, the 15th night of Nisan, is a night of contradictions. We started the night in slavery, and by the time, you know, day breaks, we're already on our way out. So it is itself a day on the Jewish calendar that marks a transition. It marks a transition from slavery to freedom. So that's the answer. Avadim hayinu l'paru b'mitzrayim. We started as slaves in Egypt. Vayotzeinu Hashem Elokeinu misham. And God took us out. When did God take us out? On the 15th. So the 15th day is internally contradictory. It means both slavery and it also relates to freedom. That's what the Abravana writes in source number 5. V'lachei na avadim hayinu l'paru b'mitzrayim. V'lachei na'ase osam ha'devarim ha'morim ala avdus. We do things which relate to our slavery. But on this night, God takes us out. We're free. We also do things which represent our freedom. In one night, in the beginning, we were slaves. And in the end, we are free. And that's the way we answer the Manish Tana. I think it's a beautiful idea. Manish Tana is one unit, and we answer a very precise answer that this night itself is a night of transitions. I heard, I don't remember where, someone quoted from Rav Eli Sadan, who is a Rosh Yeshiva of one of the Dati Lumi Yeshivot in Israel, where he has a very different understanding of the answer. Manish Tana, what's going on over here? The sun is noticing all of these peculiar activities that we do in the night of the Seder. And what's going on, Dad? And the father does not really directly address any one concern. If you look at the passage that follows the Manish Tana, there is no direct answer to any of the four questions. So Rav Eli Sadan suggests as follows. It's a beautiful idea. He says that when it comes to addressing questions, particularly questions that are in like the details of halacha, like we have to eat matzah, we have to eat maror, we have to dip twice, you can't answer questions of halacha with a very narrow response. Because if you give a very narrow response, the child does not see the beauty, the context. So the child is asking somewhat narrow questions. Why do we eat matzah? Why maror? Why are we dipping twice? Why are we leaning? And Rav Eli Sadan says, the answer demands context. You want to appreciate the minutia of the halacha? You want to appreciate the details of our legal system? You have to understand the beauty of what's taking place. So the answer of the father doesn't come immediately in terms of the details that you're asking about. The first step is let me paint a picture of what's going on. Because when you have the context to the story, then the details fall into place. And it's a beautiful insight for educators how to inspire our children. Because when our children ask us specific questions, and the more questions, the better. We talked about that on Shabbos HaGadol. But when our children ask us questions, and then we take out our halacha svarim and we show them, okay, it's machlokas between the Taz and the Magen Avraham and this and that. That's beautiful, but that does not truly satiate them. If you want to keep your children interested and engaged, you have to paint a much broader picture of the beauty of Judaism. And that might be reflected in the answer that the parent provides the child. He does not directly answer any specific inquiry of the son or the daughter, but he paints a picture. Let me share with you the beauty of what's taking place here. And that might be another way to understand the response of Avadim Hayinu. I want to share with you a beautiful Beis Halevi in source number 6 that relates to this idea that in order for the children to understand the magnificence of the freedom, you have to understand the depth of the problem. Now that's somewhat intuitive, right? The fact that we have to start telling the story of our slavery before we can talk about the magnificent Exodus, it's intuitive because we can't truly appreciate the Exodus until we appreciate the depth of the slavery. But the Beis Halevi deepens our understanding a great deal. The Beis Halevi's comments are based on a Medrash. The Medrash says something very interesting in source number 6. The Beis Halevi, who was Rabbi Soloveitchik's great-grandfather, the Rav that we talk about, this was the Rav's great-grandfather. So the Beis Halevi points out that there is a Medrash that connects two words. It's actually the same word, but used in two different contexts. If you look with me in source number 6, Omar Moshe, be'az chatati, with the word az, Aleph Zayin, I sinned. Ba'az chatati shamarti ume'az bati ledaber al paro hera la'am hazeh. So Moshe, after he initially goes to Paro, Paro makes everything much worse. Remember that? And Moshe comes back to God and he's furious. God, what are you sending me on this ridiculous mission? I've done no good. In fact, I've made everything a whole lot worse. Ume'az bati ledaber el paro, from the time that I went to Paro, hera la'amazeh, it's gotten worse. So Moshe uses the word az when he is being very critical of the Ribbono Shel Olam. And the Medrash notes that that word az also kicks off Moshe's praise to the Almighty when they're leaving Mitzrayim. What word am I referring to? When? Az Yashir. Az Yashir Moshe. And then Moshe praised the Almighty. Ba'az ani omer shira. So again, the Medrash says, with the word Az, Aleph Zayin, with that word I criticized God. Ba'az chatati. With that word I sinned against God by claiming that the whole thing is a debacle and only gotten worse. And Ba'az, with that one word Az, amarti shira. I am singing praise. So the Beis Halevi wants to understand a deeper message of the Medrash, focusing on the same word that was used in Moshe's criticism and is also used in Moshe's song. Let me share with you outside what the Beis Halevi says. Well, that just happened. That's just how the word is used in the pasuk. Umeyaz, and from when I went to Paro, it has gotten worse. But the word, the shoresh of the word is al, is az, from when.
Right.
Yeah. So the Beis Halevi explains as follows. That's just the language of the pasuk, Leon. It's not a different word. It's used.
Yes, with, yes,
yeah,
I
okay,
know that.
Okay,
it's
fine.
Shoresh.
Yeah.
But in what way does do these two bias have a different meaning?
Well, they both mean they mean when, from when.
Right.
Yeah. So az yashir Moshe, that's when Moshe is saying shira, hard words to define with 100% accuracy, but it's the same word. So what's the connection between the words? And with this understanding, we'll be able to appreciate why we focus on our slavery and why that helps enhance our understanding of our freedom. So the Beis Halevi says something really magnificent. He says that there are times in life when we are very thankful to the Almighty. So for example, if a person, God forbid, is a very, very, very close call, a near-death experience, let's say they're in a terrible accident and they walk away without any scratch whatsoever. So they come to Shem, they make a berachas hagomel. That's a tremendous miracle, correct? But the truth is that the person is thankful to the Almighty, but they would have been just as well off had the entire incident not happened at all. They would be just as happy to thank God with much fervor, having escaped an accident altogether. So they're very thankful to God. Thank you, Hashem, for saving me. But I would have been just as happy, if not happier, not having the experience altogether. That's one type of praise. There's another type of praise when a person goes through something very dramatic and difficult, and at the end they realize that they are the better for it because of their experiences. And their praise of God is not saying, Hashem, I'm happy, but I wish it never happened to me. Their praise of God is, Hashem, I'm so happy for what has happened, and I appreciate the experience for what I learned and how I grew through it. The Beis Halevi says that that's the meaning of the Medrash. Moshe initially is furious at God. God, your name has been smeared, has been profaned even more when I came originally to Paro. Because I said, God wants us to leave, and Paro says, who is this God? I'll make everything worse. So initially, I thought this experience was a wretched one, with no benefit at all. Me'az bati al Paro, I use that word. But now, I understand that that same experience has deepened us as a people. That the slavery experience was a profound one for the Jewish people. At very least, we were the conduit through which God's name was exalted in this world. Right? If you look at the whole theme of the 10 plagues, it's all about God's presence becoming more known throughout the world. And Moshe realizes that the Jewish people merited to be the people through which God's name is exalted. And they wouldn't trade that for a moment. So it's that same wretched experience, what Moshe was screaming at God about in the very beginning, that Moshe realizes they were profoundly honored to be going through. Because they were the vessel through which God's name was exalted throughout the world. So that same word that Moshe uses initially when he's criticizing God, now Moshe uses that word to sing praise to God. Because I realize how lucky we are to have gone through that experience. I don't wish it never happened. I'm happy for every day that it happened because it has been a tremendous merit for us to be the source of God's greatness being known throughout the world. And that's the connection between Oz and Oz. That's what the Beis Halevi writes in source number 6. I'll just read you a couple of excerpts from the commentary. And let's skip to number 6, paragraph number 2. Raka inyan, dine mishahu bitzar chalila, the person's in, again, a particularly dangerous situation. V'akadosh baruch hu ozro matzilo, God helps that person, saves that person. V'nosin l'kadosh baruch hu shavach v'hodaya al hatova she'asalo. A person gives thanks to the Almighty for what happened. So yesh bazeh shnei ofanim v'chalukim him harbe. There are two types of praise, and they're very different. Im ikar simchaso shel ha'adam u'mashe mishabeach lishmo yisbarach hu rak avor tovaso shekibel v'hatzalaso me'atzar. If a person is simply thankful for being saved, but that's it, lo yugdal simchaso yoser mi'ilu lo hayelo tzar mikodem, a person is not any happier than they were originally. They're just happy that they returned back to the status quo. If they were in a close call car accident, their thanks is just going back to the way life was. That's it. There's a lot to be thankful for in that situation. But they're happy to be going back to the status quo. They're not any happier than they were originally. Next paragraph. Aval hashira she'amru Moshe v'Yisroel. But the song that the Jewish people were singing at Kriyas Yamsuf, when they were marching through the sea that had split, az lo haya ikar simchasam alzeh shenitzalu miyad hamitzriim. Their happiness wasn't just about leaving Egypt and no longer being in slavery. Rak ikar simchasam haya alzeh shezachu liyosam hakli chafetz. They were the desired utensil. Asher al yadam niskadel kvodo yisparach. Through them, God's glory had increased. V'ayidei hatzalasam imitzrayim nitzparsim shemo. And through their slavery and salvation, God's name has become famous, become exalted. V'kimo she'amru ba'aschalas hashira, hashira la'ashem kigoga. Fine. V'im kein harei hashira nemra gam al hashibud. And if that's the case, their song is being sung also on their slavery. Kemo al ha'gula, also on the redemption, but it includes the slavery. De omale hashibud, if it wasn't for the subjugation, lo haya makom la'gula, there would be no place for the redemption. V'samcho be'hashibud ha'kodem, kemo ba'gula shalata. And they're equally as thankful for the slavery as they are for the redemption. V'zehu she'amar be'az chatati. That's what the Medrash means. The Moshe says, I sinned originally with that word. D'mikodem hitra'im al kavod ha'kovid hashibud. Originally Moshe says, I was screaming about the heaviness of the work. V'akshav ani omer shira be'az. But now I'm using that same word to sing songs to God. Perusho da'ani omer hashira gam al az da'ainu al hashibud ha'kodem kemol ha'gula shel akshav. Now I understand that there was a bigger purpose in mind, and we feel honored to be the conduit through which God's name is exalted. And that can only happen if there was slavery and also redemption. And that could explain, you know, this passage, Avadim Ahinu L'Paro B'Mitzrayim, we focus on our slavery. What's the point of focusing on our slavery? So the easy answer is because we talk about the transition that happened the night from slavery to freedom. But with this idea of the Beis HaLevi, I really believe it deepens our appreciation, because now we understand and we're thankful in a way for the slavery. Not that anyone is running to be punished and to be in slavery, but it's a certain appreciation that we have that all of the experiences add up to something extraordinary. And from one perspective, we feel blessed to have gone through it because of all of the benefits that accrued along the way. I think it's a beautiful idea of the Beis HaLevi. I just want to share with you a few more ideas. I've already lost count what number we're up to, but we're up to 7. Okay, so let's move on to the part of a Haggadah, which is very curious. We say a little bit later on that actually not that much later on at all. It's in the same paragraph. We say, "Va'afilu kulanu chachamim," even if we were all wise, kulanu nevonim, kulanu zikenim, kulam yodim es haTorah, even if we were all scholarly folks who knew everything about the Exodus, mitzvah aleinu l'saper b'yitzias Mitzrayim, we would still have a commandment to speak about the Exodus. So what's the question embedded in those words?
Remember your history.
Okay, well, okay, one second, but we're going to get, but what's the question?
Why do we all have to say it?
Well, I would say just the opposite. What's the hav mean? Why would I have thought to the contrary? Let me ask you a question. If a person knows every single word of Torah, let's say that could be, would such individuals still have a chiv of Talmud Torah, or they still need to learn Torah? Absolutely. Because being a scholar and knowing everything does not detract from your absolute obligations. So if a person knows everything about, I don't know, whatever the topic may be, they still have to learn it again. So why would I have thought that if I am a wise scholar, I don't need to give over the story? Again, the Haggadah is telling us, Ve'afilu, even if we are wise, even if we are scholars, we still need to say over the story. Why does the Haggadah need to tell me that? Isn't that obvious? Since when does being a scholar obviate you from fulfilling a mitzvah? You have to fulfill the mitzvah of Sipur Yitzias Mitzrayim. Why does the Haggadah need to say, don't think you can get out of this? Of course I need to do this. This is a mitzvah. Does everyone understand the question? So now what's the answer?
You're telling the story to somebody else.
Okay, interesting. Interesting.
They may not be scholars.
But then, I don't think that's what the text is telling us. I think the text is saying, even if we are all well-read and knowledgeable of the story, we still absolutely need to tell the story. In fact, the next text in the Haggadah bespeaks this point. Because what's the next text? I should have asked everyone to bring Haggadahs. I'm sorry, next year I will remind everyone. The next text is Ma'aseh Rabbi Elazar, Eliezer, Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Tarfon, Shayim Esum Ibn Brak. This is the story of the scholars who were in Ibn Brak, who were telling over the story all night long. So clearly, we're not talking about a case where a wise man is sitting with someone who is illiterate. We're talking about scholars sitting amongst themselves. They also need to tell the story. Huh? Why would I have thought to the contrary?
Recharge ourselves.
Okay, very nice. So the simple understanding that I saw was that the nature of this mitzvah is one of inquiry, where the Torah is telling us the time will come when your children will ask. Right? The fact that there's a question presupposes that there's a part of the story that you don't know. Right? The Torah tells us in source number 7 and 8, these are the verses that we expound upon for the four sons. Mazos, right? Time will come when your children will ask you, what is this? In the next verse, this is in the book of Deuteronomy, Devarim, Ki Shalcha Bincha Machar Leimor, Mahayidos Tachukim and Meshpatim, what are these laws? The point is, in both places, the Torah says that the child will ask. Meaning there's some information the child doesn't know. So what happens if you do know? Maybe you don't have to talk about the story. The fact that the Torah uses a language, it will be when your child asks, means that you're talking about a conversation where someone doesn't know everything. What happens if you know everything? Maybe you would think you don't have to tell over the story. And that's why the Haggadah has to tell me, no, no, no. Even if you know everything, you still have to tell over the story. Does that make sense? That's what we're saying. Because the Torah uses the language, and it will be when your child asks. So I would have thought, okay, but if there are no questions, because if we know everything, maybe there is no obligation to tell over the story.
You may think you know everything.
Okay, so beautiful. So what I think the deeper understanding of this line of the Haggadah is that even for great scholars, we have to understand there's still more to learn. That act of humility is so woven together with learning, right? Those people who are arrogant and pompous and think they know everything are not going to ultimately be lifelong learners, because they're going to think, I've already maxed out, I know all there is to know. And the fact that we demand of great sages to keep on telling over the story just underscores that idea that in Judaism, there is no place for arrogance at the table of scholars. Scholars have to have an appetite for learning, reviewing, learning more, learning again. And it's never acceptable to be at a place where there are no questions. You will always be v'hayak yashalcha bin chamachar. You will always be a child asking a question. It's not sufficient to never have questions, because there's always more to learn. Judy.
When we lived in Brooklyn, we lived right down the street from the Hall of Ages.
Okay.
And when the rabbi was not feeling well, he asked some of the men from the neighborhood to come to the Midday Roshanto.
Okay.
And my husband said he looked at the table to see, you know, which sparring they used.
Right. Really? Wow. Right. We're all beginners. We're all beginners. It's beautiful. I love that story. That's a beautiful story. We're all beginners. That's actually, the Meshech Chachma uses this idea to explain an interesting Medrash. The Medrash, in source number 9, the Medrash reads as follows. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Minayin Ata Omer, how do I know that if there be a group of scholars or students that they still need to be involved in learning the laws of Pesach at least until midnight? What are the laws? Maha edut v'chukim. So just give me one second. Just give me
story of Pesach, but the laws.
They're intertwined. They're intertwined. They're not separated on the night of Pesach. Studying the laws of Pesach, the story of Pesach is very much one and the same. Basically, what the Meshech Chachma does is he points to Gemara and Rosh Hashanah. And the Gemara says if there are three rabbis who comprise a Beis Din who see the new moon, so we don't say that, well, hey, a Beis Din saw the new moon, let's call it Rosh Chodesh. You know what the Gemara says? One of them has to stand in front of the other two. You bring over somebody else. And one has to give over testimony to the others. Meaning, even if three scholars see the moon, and they think, okay, we know it all, we've seen it, it doesn't stop there. That's not correct. They still require edus. They still have to give testimony. They still have to go through the motions. Because there's something to learn from listening to others. So even when the Beis Din sees the new moon, they still have to listen to somebody else give the testimony about it. So the Gemara actually describes that two of the rabbis stand and give testimony, and one of them sits and you call over a Beis Din, and you go through the whole procedure. There's no such thing as a scholar saying, I know it all. And that's the halacha of edus. That's the halacha of testimony. And that's why the Medrash says, how do we know that all the scholars must still engage in the midst of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim? The answer is from the word edus, testimony. Because it's a reference to that Gemara that even great scholars need to give testimony one to the other. There is nobody that doesn't have something to learn from someone else. I saw that it's a beautiful idea quoted in the Haggadah of Rabbi Goldshire, the night that unites, something along those lines. He has a beautiful Haggadah that brings together the ideas of Rav Kook and Rabbi Soloveitchik and Rav Shlomo Kaulbach, I think. So he quotes from Rabbi Soloveitchik that another reason we start our Seder by inviting people in is because a Jew realizes that we have a lot to learn from other people. So our our Seder will be enriched by having new and fresh perspectives from people at the table. So we start off halach, I'm going back to the beginning now, but we start off halach ma'anya, kol dichvin yesev yechol, whoever is hungry, might be intellectually hungry, whoever is curious, let them come and eat, let's have a conversation. Because the more people at our Seder table, the more perspectives we have, the more we can learn one from the other. So that is an additional dimension to our understanding of the words in the Haggadah, even if we were all wise. Why would I feel to the contrary? Well, even because the Torah talks about questions and answers, and I would think if you have no more questions, you don't have to tell the story. But on a deeper level, the Torah is telling us, the Haggadah rather, is telling us that everyone has to have questions. And we're never at a point in life where we don't have something to learn from going over a story, from talking to others about a story. And it's not just the story, Leon, it's the laws of Pesach. There's something to be learned from others, and there's something to be learned even from ourselves the more we go over and learn again. Just one last insight, and then I'm going to finish off with a quick story. The last insight relates to the part of the Haggadah where we say, Baruch Hamakom Baruch Hu, Baruch Shenasan Torah Li'amo Yisrael. Blessed is God, blessed is He, blessed is He who gave the Torah to His people Israel, blessed be He. Right? Baruch Hamakom Baruch Hu. It's a nice jolly song that we sing. It sounds very similar to Berachas HaTorah, the blessings that we say over the Torah. Think about the language that we say when we get an aliyah for the men in the room. Asher bachar banu mikol ha'amim, v'nasam lanu es Torah. So we thank God for choosing us amongst the people, for giving us the Torah. We say, Baruch Ata Hashem, nosein ha'Torah. And what's the language we use over here in the Haggadah? Baruch shenasan Torah li'amo Yisrael. Blessed is God who gave the Torah to Israel. So we have a Berachas HaTorah, we have a blessing over the Torah. So why do we have a blessing over the Torah in the Haggadah? So I want to share with you one beautiful answer. We don't have time to read it inside. But on the night of the Seder, our rabbis wanted to remind us that the exodus from Egypt was not an end to itself, but was a means to an end. Leaving Egypt was just the beginning. What was the real purpose of our exodus? What was the real purpose of our exodus? To receive the Torah. And even that was not the full picture. It was really to get the Torah and to live in Israel. But at very least, it was not just to leave Egypt. It was not slavery, so we could be free and play Candy Crush. I think I know every day on Facebook I have about 300 invitations to play Candy Crush. I don't even know what it is. But it must be something that's very engaging and certainly very intellectually stimulating, I'm sure. But the point is that we did not leave Egypt to sit around and twiddle our thumbs. We left Egypt to receive the Torah. And our rabbis remind us here in the Haggadah, we make a Berachas HaTorah of sorts. We make a blessing over the Torah to remind us that the purpose of the Exodus was to receive the Torah. Baruch Shenasan Torah Li'amo Yisrael. And Nachmanides Ramban tells us that although we think about Pesach as an isolated holiday, it's not really the case. You know, just like on Pesach with the first days and the last days and the days of the middle are Chol HaMoed, familiar, right? The truth is, it's one big holiday. What do you mean one big holiday? Pesach and Shavuos. And the days in between are really Chol HaMoed. Pesach is the first leg of the holiday. Shavuos is the last leg of the holiday, and the days in between are really like a Chol HaMoed. They're actually very special days. Rav Avadia Yosef has a tshuva where he says that people always associate the Omer as like a sad time, and there were certain calamities that befell the Jewish people in that time period. That's true. But how do we frame this time period? With joy, with excitement. Because Pesach is not Pesach by itself. Pesach is really deeply connected to Shavuos. I'm sure that's a topic we'll keep coming back to in Shul. It's a profound topic. But that could explain why we have a Berachas HaTorah, blessing over Torah, in the Haggadah to remind us about the ultimate purpose of the Exodus to receive the Torah. So let me just review very quickly, and I want to share with you just one very short story. We started with two reasons for Halach Manya. Number one, the importance of inviting people to our home as the hallmark of the Jewish expression of joy. We talked about the insight of the Rav that the ability to think of others is the hallmark of a free man. And that's why we start the Seder with Halach Manya. We spoke about the Abravanel's point that Manishtana is one unit, which talks about the contradictions of the night of the Seder. We spoke about the answer to the question of the Abravanel. It's a night of transitions. We saw even a more beautiful, and not more beautiful, but a different answer, I should say, from the Beis Halevi, that we appreciate the slavery and also the freedom. Meaning it's not just we don't just focus on the get out of jail. We focus on the slavery because we realize that we were the kli. We were the conduit through which God's name was exalted, and we're thankful for every part of the process. And that's why Moshe uses the same word when being critical of God, but that same word resurfaces when he's singing the praise of the Almighty. We spoke about why I would have thought that a wise person, a scholar, does not need to tell the story, but ultimately why even scholars have something to learn. We never stop learning, and that's why even those two types of people need to engage in the midst of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. We finished off with Baruch HaMakom Baruch Hu, and I'll just share with you one beautiful story which is found in the Haggadah of Rabbi Yosef Rimon, which is an absolute must. It's a beautiful English sefer. Magnificent Haggadah. Magnificent Haggadah. I imagine if you listen to some of the Haggadah Shema and Wayu Torah, almost every rabbi will say, if you're going to buy one book, buy this book. It's by Rabbi Yosef Tzvi Rimon. It's called the Pesach Haggadah. So in here, it speaks about everything. But in particular, I want to share with you just a short story he talks about in the context of Vehisha Amda. We know we pick up our cups, and we say how God's promise has sustained us throughout all the years of the exile. No matter what has happened to the Jewish people, God is always there for us. So in that context, listen to the story he relates, and with this I close. It's a story from Rav Yonah Emanuel, as told at the bris of his grandson. So this is a story that Rav Yonah Emanuel, who lived in Israel, was a survivor of the Holocaust, told at the circumcision of his grandson. I would like to tell you what happened 40 years ago today. I was unable to tell this story until now. I never told it to my wife, I never told it to my children, and I never told it to anyone. I was unable to. For the first time, I feel I can tell it now at the bris of my grandson, Aaron Hanana. On the morning before Pesach Eve in the year 5705, which is 1945, I set out for hard physical labor in the Bergen-Belsen concentration camp, as I had done every day for the previous 2 years. I came back at night utterly and totally exhausted, as I did every night during those 2 years. I was 19 years old. My father was already dead, my older brother Elchanan was already dead, my younger brother Shalom was already dead, and my younger sister Batya was not among the living. The Bergen-Belsen concentration camp was not an extermination, but a labor camp. And Jews died of the unbelievably hard labor, the terrible cold, starvation, disease. During that time, hundreds of Jews died each day in Bergen-Belsen. I went to the hut where my mother was. She was very ill. I sat next to her and began to recite the Haggadah. We had no wine, we had no matzah, we did not even have any bread. We only had one thing in great abundance, maror. There was a very great amount of maror, bitterness, in our hearts. I whispered the Haggadah, and I was not sure whether my mother heard me or did not hear me. When it came to the blessing of deliverance, I said the words, "So too, Lord our God and God of our fathers, enable us to reach future holidays and festivals in peace, rejoicing in the rebuilding of your city, and ecstatic in your service." I felt for the first time I did not believe what I was saying. Would any of us there reach future holidays and festivals? Would any of us ever see Jerusalem? Would any of us ever rejoice again? I burst into tears, and in the middle of the blessing, I stopped reciting the Haggadah. If only I had been able to describe to myself on that Pesach Eve of 1945, a hint of what has taken place today, had I been able to imagine that I would be privileged to come to Israel with my sister and my two brothers, that I would be privileged to live in a Jewish country, that I would be able to establish a family, to raise 7 children, to be a tzaddik at the bris of my grandson in Jerusalem 40 years later. Had I been able to imagine any of that, I might have been able to complete the reading of the Haggadah. V'hi sha'am d'lav oseinu. There is a covenant that remains for the Jewish people. And in the night of the Seder, we speak about the darkest of moments, but we also have the courage to hope for a salvation. Thank you very much.